This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, the first of two special editions of Little Atoms, with shortlisted authors for this year's Welcome Book Prize. On Wednesday the 29th of April, the winner of the 2015 Welcome Book Prize will be announced. And I'm delighted to say that Little Atoms is covering the prize again this year. What you're about to listen to is the first of two special editions of Little Atoms. And coming up are interviews with shortlisted authors Miriam Taves, Scott Stossel and Sarah Moss. Miriam Taves was born in 1964 in the small Mennonite town of Steinbach, Manitoba. She has published four novels and a memoir of her father, and is the recipient of numerous literary awards, including the Governor General's Award, the McNally Robinson Book of the Year Award, twice, and the Rogers Writers Trust Fiction Prize. Her latest novel is All My Puny Sorrows, which is shortlisted for the 2015 Welcome Book Prize. So, Miriam, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Can you describe for us what the story of All My Puny Sorrows is about?
It's about two sisters, and they're in their 40s, and one of them very much wishes to die. The oldest sister, who's an accomplished concert pianist, is suicidal, and the younger sister very much wants to keep her alive, and that's the central conflict in the story.
Now, the key thing to know about this story is it's very, very autobiographical, isn't it?
It is, yes. Yes, my sister committed suicide in 2010 after a number of attempts, and my father also did in 1998. So it's something, obviously, the subject of suicide is something that I think about a lot and that figures into my work, and especially so in this book. And like you say, it's this book, All My Puny Sorrows, is very autobiographical. I didn't think that I would write anything, actually, at all after my sister died in 2010. But eventually, after a few years passed, I realized that I needed to and that I would, and so that's when I started writing the book.
I said in the introduction that you wrote a memoir about your father, Swing Low, A Life, it's called, and that is about his life and his suicide. So why do it in a novel this time?
Well, when my father died, that was the first time that anybody that I knew had committed suicide, had killed himself. And it was a concept, obviously a concept that I knew of, but just never had crossed my mind that something like that could happen. And it hadn't occurred to any of us in our family that this was something that could happen. We knew that he was very depressed and had suffered from depression and bipolar disorder for most of his life. He was diagnosed at 17. It was called manic depression then, but has since come to be called bipolar disorder. And he had gone through some really hard times, and it just never had occurred to us that he would kill himself. And so after he did, and there was no indication, there were no previous attempts, that he didn't talk about it. There was just nothing that would have us believe that that's what he was planning to do. And so after he died, I had just so many questions. How could this have happened? Why did this happen? And I was reading absolutely everything that I could get my hands on in terms of suicide and mental illness and depression and survivor's guilt and all of those things. And basically, I thought that I had wanted to write about his life and not just focusing on the fact that he suffered from mental illness and that he killed himself, but the happier, normal parts of his life as well. So with all of those questions that I had in mind, I decided that I would basically write the memoir, the so-called memoir, from his point of view. And I thought, okay, if I can get into my father's head, then I can come closer to understanding why he did what he did. And so for me at that time, it made sense to write that book that way. And so everything that happens in that book happened in his life. It's nonfiction in a sense, and yet, of course, because I'm writing it from his point of view, you could say that it's fiction as well. I mean, I'm sure there are other books like this, and what do we call them? I don't know, but in this case, it's been labeled a memoir. Then, after my sister died in 2010, I, of course, had come a little bit closer to understanding why and how. I didn't have those questions weren't the kind of prominent thing going on in my head. I was more concerned with understanding, or at least dealing with the notion of assisted suicide, of understanding what it means to love somebody who wants to die. What are our obligations, our responsibilities in that context? What are that person's rights? What should they be entitled to. I know that if I think only of my sister and think if there was a way that she wouldn't have had to have died alone and violently, then why couldn't that have been made available to her? She had very, very clearly expressed her intentions and her wish to die, and there was no surprise when she was successful. So I thought I wanted to talk about that and deal with that subject in my fiction, and I also wanted to kind of touch on what it means to survive afterwards, to go on living. I wanted it to be a book about love, about, I wanted it to be hopeful. I wanted it to be a kind of living, breathing document to survival, really, and to choice. And for me, it was easier to create a fuller picture. And this is, you know, this is a trope, a cliche within literature, as I'm sure you know. You fictionalize something to get closer to the truth. And so I chose to write it, to call it fiction, even though, you know, this fiction, this so-called fiction, this novel is so autobiographical, and the nonfiction, the memoir, you know, is kind of fictional. So they sort of, they go together and yet are shelved differently in stores.
The question that obviously in any form of fictionalized autobiographical novel, the question that is raised is how autobiographical? And the sister, Yoli, that's based on yourself, she, you know, she gets up to some interesting stuff in this book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the character of Yoli, is, you know, I want to say a more messed up version of me, but probably not even, probably just as messed up, and with the same kind of chaotic life. I mean, I too have, you know, I've been through a divorce. I'm very happily now ensconced with my new partner, but I have, my kids aren't teenagers anymore. But I've had teenagers. I've sort of struggled in, you know, in the writing life and just all of the things that Yolandi is going through. And then all of those kind of very typical things that a middle-aged woman often faces. And the more unique thing that Yolandi is, you know, is struggling with, her biggest challenge, of course, is trying at the very beginning of the novel to do whatever she can to keep her sister alive, to somehow make her want to live and to keep her alive. And she's desperate. And at a certain point in the book, she starts to think about those things that I mentioned earlier, about what our responsibilities are when we love somebody who wants to die, who's sane, who's clear-minded, who says, this is what I want and I need you to help me, please. What do we do in those circumstances? And Yolandi begins to think about that. And that was exactly the situation that I was in with my own sister. After several attempts with her, I knew, you know, we all knew that there was a 99% chance that she would be successful given the opportunity. And my own sister had asked me to take her to one of these clinics in Switzerland. And I, at the time, I mean, that just seems impossible. It just seems untenable. It just seems like absolutely not. Of course not. How can I do that? I want you to live. I need you to live. I want you to want to live. But then, you know, I started thinking differently. Yolandi started thinking differently. But of course, I didn't think quickly enough. I was too late. And my own sister died violently and alone. And I didn't take her to the clinic. And that was the one thing that she had begged me to do. And so Yolandi, the character, has the same struggle.
While you were writing this, and certainly since it's been published, that assisted suicide debate has sort of heated up in Canada a bit.
Oh, it sure has. Yeah, no, I mean, there's a conversation, an ongoing conversation now, and has been for a while. It's something that I think most Canadians, you know, agree that it's humane and that it's compassionate and that there needs to be some kind of option for people who are, you know, who choose to die. And of course, there has to be all sorts of checks and balances and things taken into consideration. And there is resistance to it, of course, particularly from religious groups. And I understand that and appreciate that. So it's very, very complicated. But here in Canada, the law recently, the Supreme Court of Canada actually threw out the old law, making it illegal to assist with suicide for doctors. And so now, and that just happened very, very recently. And so now Parliament and the various provinces, government have a year to implement this new ruling from the Supreme Court of Canada. So it's going to be very interesting to see how that all pans out.
I'm author I. Miller. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Adams, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I wanted to say as well, just talking about writing a novel rather than writing it as a memoir, although of course, and I haven't read the memoirs, but the novel is, for a book about such a not only a powerful subject, but a very personal subject. It's really funny. And so, I mean, I guess if you were writing a non-fiction version, that would have been more difficult.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think it would have been more difficult because I find I'm most relaxed writing fiction. I find that funny stuff or the comedy of it comes to me more easily when I'm writing fiction. The opportunities, yeah, there's just so much more room and space for imposing one's own, mindset or outlook into the narrative. The other thing is too. I mean, I was really, really concerned with the tone of the book. I didn't want to put readers off. Of course, the book is about depression and suicide. I mean, these are dark, depressing subjects, and a lot of people are afraid of them. I am to a certain degree, so when I was writing the book, I just thought, okay, the tone here is so important. I want to do justice to credence to the very seriousness of the topic, of course, and to the pain that so many people experience when they are suffering from that kind of despair. And yet I want it to also to, in a sense, honor the funny lives that my sister and I had with each other, the humor that ran kind of throughout everything with us in my family, in our family, that it was important, that it defined us in a certain way. My sister was the funniest person I've known. She made me laugh harder than anybody. I wanted her, in my thoughts, I could think, okay, I'm going to create this scene, and even though it's so dark and sad, maybe this would be the thing that would make her laugh, were she able to read it. And so that was absolutely essential, that there was that they go hand in hand, the funny and the sad throughout. And then I wanted my readers to feel confident that they could come with me through this book, through these dark subjects, and come out at the end in a lighter place where there was some light, some hope.
I want to talk about the title, All My Puny Sorrows. It comes from a Coleridge poem, which is the poem itself is about the death of his sister. It also plays a part in the story, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. That's right. The All My Puny Sorrows is like you say, the line from the Coleridge poem. And I'm paraphrasing here. I haven't read it in a while, but something about Coleridge writes something like, it's only a sister. It's only a sister that you can pour out all your puny sorrows to and still have them heard and acknowledged. And like you say, he's just lost his sister. But in the book, Elfrida, the older sister, kind of uses that as her stamp, her logo in a way. And goes around town, around their hometown, writing AMPS, which, of course, is an acronym for All My Puny Sorrows. And she also believes that, that Samuel Coleridge would most definitely have been her boyfriend if he had been born at the right time or if she had been born at the right time. And so she goes around the town. And, of course, everything that Elfrida and Yoli and their entire family do, almost everything in that town, is met with disapproval by the church elders. It's a Mennonite community, very conservative, fundamentalist religious community, and the Von Riesen family doesn't follow rules easily.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the community. I mean, that's the community you come from yourself, obviously, and it's something as well as this subject matter, the community and the place, that sort of, the small town Manitoba place, East Village, as it's called in the book, are things that feature throughout your work. So, yeah, so for a British audience who are not familiar, who are the Mennonites?
Well, the Mennonites are—they're very much like the Amish. They began the Mennonites in the 1500s in Holland. They came from Holland, and so their last name is Von Riesen. That was basically the family's name is Von Riesen, which was my mother's maiden name. They were a breakaway sect, basically led by this guy named Menno Simon. And their credo was that they would be in the world but not of the world. And so the two kind of main tenets of the Mennonite faith are adult baptism and pacifism. A lot of Mennonites have been persecuted, throughout history, and they've been exiled and have been on the run, moving from place to place to place. Certain governments in certain places will give them some kind of land. Okay, you can go to this kind of, crappy little piece of land and farm it and stay away from everybody and do your own weird thing, but don't bother us. And then something will change and there'll be some revolution or whatever it is, and they'll be kicked out and have to be on the move again. So my group of Mennonites came from, obviously from Holland, where they all came from, but then, a few hundred years later, from Russia. So there are Russian Mennonites and there are Swiss Mennonites and there are German Mennonites and et cetera, et cetera. And then they came from Russia to Canada and settled in where they were given land. There was a deal made by Catherine the Great and Canadian government, and they were given this deal, this land, kind of very inhospitable land in the central part of Canada, and they could farm it. So that's where my grandparents came, and that's where I grew up and where I lived in this area. And it's a very conservative Mennonite community. There are different types of Mennonites who you can tell they're Mennonites by the way they dress, long dresses for the women and hair, long hair and braids and hats for the men and that sort of thing. And those are the very old order Mennonites. My group of Mennonites just dressed like mostly like everybody else. So you couldn't really tell just by looking, but if you would have come to my hometown, you know, you would have understood that there was a very strange and fundamentalist group of religious people living there.
Writing this novel and writing the memoir and, you know, touching on depression and other aspects of your work are obviously ways for you to work through the things that have happened and to deal with them yourself. I mean, what has the reception to this novel been from other people?
Well, the reception has been very positive here. I've been on the road with it, in a way, touring it and promoting it and going to festivals and readings and things like that. And before the book came out, I'd kind of made this plan with myself that I would do whatever I could to talk about it and say yes to just about everything, because I so wanted to tell the story. I wanted the story to be out there and again, to be a part, a tiny little part of that conversation about the topics that we were talking about before. For depression and suicide and assisted death and dying. And so in the course of doing that over the last year, I've met so many people with similar stories to mine, to my sisters, to my family. And that's been incredibly rewarding, very, very sad and hard to hear, of course, but also, you know, when we write books, we hope that we have that connection with our readers, even if we don't necessarily meet them. So the reception has been very, very positive, and also, I haven't really received a lot of backlash from religious groups either, who may or may not be opposed to some of the themes in the book.
Now, I would finish off ask you what you're going to do next. What I really want to know is, when are we going to see your rodeo novel?
Yeah. Well, that's you and thousands of others are waiting. No, that's not true. Actually, nobody's waiting for the rodeo novel. That's a good question. Yeah, I have a couple of writer friends here, and they keep saying, "Look, if you're not going to write it, I will." You know, and I keep saying, "Yeah, just go for it." You know, so maybe there'll be a ton of rodeo novels coming out of Canada in the next little while. Just none of them will be mine. I don't know. I mean, I do kind of like rodeos, even though they're very politically incorrect. And I used to be a barrel racer as a kid, so I have this fond, nostalgic kind of memory of, you know, horses and horse shit.
What is barrel racing? I did see that on your Wikipedia page. I don't know what barrel racing is.
So barrel racing is like you're on a horse, you're not on a barrel. But there are three barrels set up, and then you're timed. It's an individual thing, and you're just timed, and you have to go flying around these barrels in a certain pattern and make really tight corners and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Finally then, what does it mean to you to be shortlisted for the Wellcome Prize?
Oh, it's a huge honor. It's amazing. I mean, I haven't read all of the other books. I've read some of them, and I intend to read all of the other books. And they're just, I mean, to be with this group of people is astonishing to me, to be picked and then to be with these writers. It's just a huge honor. And I really am really, really looking forward to meeting some of these other writers and talking, you know, the subjects. There's such a range of different subjects. It's an honor, and I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it.
I've been talking to Miriam Taves. We've been talking about her book, All My Puny Sorrows. Miriam, thank you very much for telling me about it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
I'm Christopher Bolin. Go and read some great new journalism and explore the interview archive at littleadams.com.
Scott Stossel is the editor of The Atlantic magazine and the author of the New York Times bestseller, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, which was shortlisted for the 2015 Wellcome Book Prize. So, Scott, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
How would you describe the book?
Well, it's sort of a mixture of memoir of my own experience, lifelong experiences and struggles with anxiety and anxiety disorders. But I try to weave that together, basically use myself as a case study from which I can jump off and talk about the culture, intellectual history and culture and science of anxiety. And initially, it's actually set out to write a book that didn't have very much of me in it at all. I thought I would do sort of more of an academic book of research into the history and culture and science of anxiety, and it would just be inflected a little bit with my own experiences. But as I worked on the book, sort of guided by both my editor and my psychotherapist, they kept saying, well, put more of yourself into the book. So in the end, it really is kind of a memoir of what I've been through over my 45 years on Earth, struggling with this and trying different modes of treatment. But as I say, using my own narrative as a kind of jumping off point to talk about what cutting edge treatments are today, how different eras throughout history have conceptualized anxiety in different ways, some of the philosophical questions that attend to, is anxiety a spiritual condition or a medical problem or a psychological issue or all of the above, and basically to take me where my curiosity and where I hope the reader's interest leads.
Let's, in very general terms then, talk about what you mean by anxiety, because that sounds on the surface like a daft question, but it's quite a difficult thing to pin down. And indeed, it's really quite recently that it's been even categorized by the medical establishment as a sort of category of mental illness, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, it didn't officially exist. The anxiety disorders didn't exist before 1980. When they were written into the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, third edition, which came out that year. And before that, what are now known as anxiety disorders had been called, neuroses, using kind of a Freudian nomenclature. And, one of the things that was interesting to me, we all have kind of a general sense of what we think anxiety means as a kind of layman's term. But when I set out to try to write about it, obviously I wanted a precise definition, and I found that, there really isn't one, or on the other hand, there are so many different ones depending on what kind of specialist you ask. In the end, what I kind of landed on is, obviously this thing we call anxiety has existed in human nature and in humans from the beginning of human time, and you can read ancient case studies from the Greek physician Hippocrates in the 4th century BC or the Roman physician Galen in the 2nd century AD, and they're not using the term anxiety, but they are describing clinical cases that would today very clearly be described as anxiety disorders. But I sort of end up borrowing from Darwin, and Darwin says that anxiety is anticipation of future suffering. And when we talk about what's the difference between, say, fear and anxiety, and Freud had a set of definitions that kind of differentiated. Fear is a normal physiological and psychological response to real, actual danger, a lion that's confronting you on the street or in the jungle, or a mugger that's confronting you, and then you respond appropriately, whereas anxiety is an emotion and a set of physiological reactions that are either in response to something that is actually not objectively dangerous, or the response is disproportionate to the threat. And it can be either acute, like in a panic attack, or it can be kind of more like rumination, just constant worrying about future uncertain events. And but anxiety is related to fear in that really what the anxiety response, what a panic attack is the fight or flight response gone awry, which is again a normal evolutionarily adaptive response to being in genuine danger. You want, when you're confronted by a member of the enemy tribe or in real danger, to have the blood flow away from your digestive system to the large muscles in your arms and legs, and your pupils to dilate so your perception increases and prepares you to fight or to flee. That's adaptive when you're in real danger. When you're sitting in your office or on a subway or in an airplane or on a date, that's when it becomes miserable and debilitating and not adaptive at all.
I want to talk a little bit about how your own experiences of anxiety manifest themselves. But to get into that, you at the beginning of the book, you list a series of often common phobias that you happen to suffer in. It's a long list, but things like, you know, claustrophobia and agoraphobia and fear of flying. But there's one there, turophobia, which I'd not come across before. So can you tell us what that is?
Yes, that's an unusual one. It's a phobia of cheese. And I have ever so often will run into somebody else who suffers from it, but it is pretty rare. And it's somewhere between a classic phobia and an acute aversion. And I think it relates to another one of my slightly more idiosyncratic but still common phobias, which is emetophobia, which is the fear, sort of pathological fear of vomiting, which actually, you know, in the age of the internet, researchers are starting to realize that actually that maybe is frequent as the fifth most common phobia. And I've heard from a lot of people in the U.S. and in the U.K. that after reading my book, you know, they're like, oh, I thought I was the only person who had this. I didn't even know the word for it, but it's emetophobia. In sort of family lore, there was this occasion when I was 5 years old, and I was about to get on an airplane, and my sister's 2 years younger than I am, and she ate a piece of cheese off the airport floor. And my mother, who, like me, is sort of a germ-phobe and an emetophobe, made a big deal about the fact that, oh, she's going to get sick from eating this piece of cheese because it's probably contaminated with germs. And sure enough, you know, a couple days later, my sister came down with a stomach virus, and I remember this quite vividly. So one theory that various psychotherapists have ventured, which seems plausible to me, is that somehow in my head, this linked, you know, cheese to fear of vomiting. And then, you know, I think that, you know, certain kinds of cheeses actually smell vaguely like, you know, emesis. So somehow these things may have gotten linked in my mind. But or it may be some completely weird sublimated Freudian explanation for why I am terrified of cheese.
I'm Emily Mayhew. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Let's widen this out then and talk about how anxiety has affected your life.
Well, it started when, you know, I talked about the book, I was first officially diagnosed when I was 10 years old, but it had, and I, you know, before that, I wouldn't have known how to describe my, you know, affliction, as it were, but, you know, I was a very nervous kid, and you know, from a very young age, I had acute separation anxiety, and whenever I was separated from my parents, I was convinced that they had died in a car crash, or that they'd run away and abandoned me, or that they were, you know, space aliens who'd gone back to their planets after conducting whatever experiments they were conducting on me. And I would actually, you know, every night when I would come home, I literally paced grooves into the rug of my carpet in my childhood bedroom, because I would just pace in circles, you know, in these paroxysms of misery, convinced that they died. And then around that same time was when I developed the emetophobia, the fear of vomiting. And so I would frequently, you know, anytime someone at school got sick or if a relative were sick, I would just, you know, be almost non-functional for, I did all kinds of research into, you know, the average period of incubation, and I would worry for that entire period that I was about to get sick, and spend a lot of time in the nurse's office convinced that I was sick. So anyway, then when I got into young adulthood, I mean, this is again sort of a classic textbook unfolding of anxiety disorders, but I developed you know, sort of panic attacks and elements of social anxiety. And, you know, so starting when I was, I guess, when I was in seventh grade, I had kind of a breakdown where I literally, you know, couldn't, I was so afraid of going to school and that my parents would have to physically, you know, wrestle me into my clothes, force me into the car. And so that was when I started medication. This was in the early 80s, and they put me on Thorazine, which at the time, it's really an antipsychotic that was considered a major tranquilizer and was prescribed for, you know, severe anxiety, and also imipramine, which is a member of the tricyclic genre of antidepressants. And those actually kind of stabilized me enough to keep me in school, but also kind of launched me onto a lifelong experience of kind of being a guinea pig. And, you know, many people who suffer from anxiety, depression, or other psychiatric disorders have the experience of, you know, trying one drug combination and then another and another. And, you know, it takes a while to find one that works. And then one that works for a while will then stop working. You have to try another one, and you have to go through the agony of, you know, sort of withdrawal from the one medication, side effects from the new medication. And of course, people who are prone to anxiety overinterpret and maybe even over-experience or experience more acutely these side effects than somebody who didn't suffer from anxiety. So it can become kind of a painful ordeal.
So what else is, though? I mean, apart from for people now, like right now, today's world, trying to be treated for anxiety disorder, apart from that huge combination cocktail of various combinations of drugs, what other things can you do? What sort of, so what other treatments are there?
Well, what research suggests are the most effective treatments, in addition to various forms of medication, are, you know, variants of what's known as cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, as they call it for short. And basically, as I said, they're sort of different strains, but what it involves, particularly in the treatment of anxiety disorder, is a mixture of exposure therapy, which is, in fact, what it sounds like, exposing yourself to the thing that you are phobic of. So if you have fear of heights, it means, you know, gradually going to higher and higher buildings and, you know, walking out on the balcony. If you have a fear of airplanes, it's first walking onto the airplane when it's on the ground, and maybe going with a therapist and a pilot, you know, up in the air. So it's exposing yourself to the thing that you're afraid of, and then doing what they call kind of cognitive retraining or reframing, and, you know, learning how to adjust your thoughts and to kind of reality test and reframe your cognition so that the thing that you're irrationally afraid of becomes not so frightening. You know, a lot of studies show that this is as effective, if not more so, than medication at reducing the symptoms of anxiety and reducing phobias. But it comes, you know, it's much without side effects or the cost of buying medications. And for some people, you know, a fairly short course of cognitive behavioral therapy can be quite effective. And then another mode of therapy that's becoming more common and more studied is, you know, emerges from kind of Eastern medicine, and that's, you know, mindfulness meditation. And there's all kinds of emerging studies from neuroscience that show that even novice meditators can, you know, increase their sense of well-being and reduce their level of anxiety and literally affect physical changes in their brain that you can see in an MRI scanner, where the amygdala, which is kind of the seat of fear in your brain, literally shrinks when you meditate regularly. And, you know, the connections in your frontal cortex, which is kind of the reasoning part of your brain that can overcome the anxiety, grow more dense and interconnected. So those two are probably two of the most cutting edge. And then, as I said, there's all kinds of research on new drugs and other forms of talk therapy. But that's generally where I steer people who come to me if they're looking for advice.
And there are, you've done the exposure therapy that you talk about. There's various darkly comic sequences in this book where you attempt this therapy. So did you find it successful?
Well, in the case you're referencing, no, absolutely not. And emetophobia is notably hard to treat with exposure therapy for, you know, whereas it's pretty easy to, you know, if you're claustrophobic, to go into tighter and tighter enclosed spaces or heights, you know, going to higher and higher buildings. You know, to confront your emetophobia, you actually, you know, some therapists say you have to actually vomit and then, you know, process the experience and learn that it's not so terrifying. And so what I did, which is evidently fairly common, you know, first my therapist had me watch, they actually have, if you had a video compilation of people in movies and TV shows vomiting, that I would have to, you know, sit there and watch, and she'd ask me what my level of anxiety was. And then sometimes she'd actually have me do this, combine my fears, like I have a, you know, fear of public speaking, so I would like be giving a talk to a bunch of graduate students while over on the side of the conference room there'd be a loop of people vomiting playing. It was just a sort of surreal, absurdist tableau. But then it wasn't really succeeding in mitigating my anxiety. So she said, well, really what you have to do is make yourself vomit. So eventually I agreed to take Ipecac syrup, which is a emetic, which makes you, is supposed to make you throw up. But I took a double dose of it, and I felt incredibly nauseous and spent a couple of miserable hours in the basement of this psychology center, you know, dry heaving into a toilet, but never actually threw up. And these things came out the other side of this experience, you know, more anxious than ever about throwing up. And the irony was that my psychologist, who was with me through the whole ordeal, there was a psychologist and a nurse who were standing there with me in the restroom. The nurse eventually gave up and got frustrated and left and said, I've never seen anybody take Ipecac and not vomit. And then my poor psychotherapist got so nauseated watching me retch, she ended up getting sick. So as I say in the book, it's sort of ironic that the Ipecac that I took made someone else get sick. But this was sort of an extreme example, and you know, I subsequently learned that actually, you know, a disproportionate, you know, or a surprising number of people who are severe emetophobes, actually you can find on the internet, you know, they took Ipecac and didn't vomit because their will not to do so and their fear of doing so is so acute they can sort of resist it. So there are probably better ways of going about that kind of exposure, and most kinds of phobias or don't have that problem of needing to, you know, make yourself do something like throw up.
Where are we now with the science of what anxiety is, where it comes from? There's always been these sort of ongoing tussle between, is it biological, is it psychological, is it a genetic thing, is it a nurture thing? And it's all, there's no firm conclusions, is there? It's all a bit of a mess, really, the science at the moment.
Exactly. And I don't think we'll ever, and I think it's a good thing, actually, that we'll never definitively untangle the interrelationship between, what quotient of anxiety or any element of our personality is genes versus environment versus upbringing versus, you know, luck and trauma and all that. But piles and piles of research that are accumulating in both sort of neuroscience and molecular genetics is really, really fascinating. And again, I don't think they'll ever reduce a given anxiety disorder or a given psychological trait to a single gene. But researchers are learning more and more about sort of constellation of genes that give rise to different temperaments and different sort of physiological processes in the brain that are associated with different emotions or temperaments. And as those develop, they're also developing, you know, it may be that we get better at tailoring or knowing which medication works with which sort of genotype, which set of genes that you have. You can get tests to see, Prozac versus some other antidepressant going to be more likely or less likely to work for you than some other drug based on what we know about other people who have the variants of the genes that you have. But, you know, I came into the book thinking that there was a strong genetic component to anxiety. I came away with an even stronger sense. I mean, I talk about my family history and then I go through a lot of the research. But so that's kind of the foundation. But overlaid on top of that are all kinds of other things, like what was, Freud was right. What was your early childhood like? What was your upbringing like? Have you been exposed to trauma? And then just kind of the luck of circumstances, identical twins who have the exact same genetics. One of them has anxiety disorder. The other one is extremely likely to develop anxiety disorder and much more likely than, two random people or even two non-twin siblings. But they're not guaranteed to have it. So there's clearly something more than genetics at work here that can kind of insert itself into how personalities and psychological kind of traits and disorders develop.
Where are you now? Because, we're talking about a long list of anxiety disorders, but you're a published author and, you're the editor of a political magazine, which is obviously an incredibly stressful position to be in as well. So how, apart from the various drug regimens and whatever that we've already sort of touched on, how do you deal with it day to day?
It varies. And like many people who have this, I have good days and bad days and good stretches of, months and bad stretches of months. And, it correlates predictably with, the level of external stressors in my life. I continue to take medications which would help keep it under control, and I've gotten much better at kind of titrating the dosages of benzodiazepines, which are short-acting kind of anti-anxiety medications. There's a certain irony. I originally got the idea to write a book about my anxiety when my first book was coming out 10 years ago, which is a biography of Sergeant Shriver, who founded the Peace Corps for President Kennedy here in the United States in the 1960s. And I was terrified in 2004 when my book tour was looming that I was going to have to go and speak in front of large audiences and go on live TV. And I was just absolutely terrified. And that's when I sort of sought out multiple courses of therapy. So the irony is I ended up writing the book, and here I am rewarded, 10 years later with another book tour.
It's another version of exposure therapy.
Well, I was going to say exactly the sort of benefit has been that it was kind of a, protracted exposure therapy. When the hardcover came out in the United States last year, I had to do many of the things that scare me. I was flying around and going on the radio and, I relied on medication, but it does, as the exposure therapist and cognitive behavioral therapist tell you, it gets easier with practice. And the difference this time was, one of my fears before with the first book and just in my life generally was always, I like many people who suffer clearly from panic disorder, was very good, better than I realized, at hiding my anxiety. And I was terrified that my anxiety would be exposed. If I had a panic attack, while I was giving a lecture and had to run off stage, which actually has happened to me, but if it happened in a, high stakes venue, or if I had a, public breakdown, like, I thought this would be humiliating and awful. But then having published a book that basically laid out all these fears and revealed my anxiety, I sort of preemptively outed myself. And so I sort of consoled myself with my most recent book tour by telling myself that if ever I did have to run off stage, I could just sort of yell out to the crowd, I'm really sorry about this, just look at chapter 4. And they would explain, they would understand exactly what happened. So that actually did reduce my anxiety, and then just the process of kind of coming out as anxious and not having the world end, did kind of, I think, lower my baseline level of anxiety a little bit. That said, you know, I do still struggle with it. And there's this kind of meta problem of, you know, people who have social anxiety, as I say, you know, you're afraid that everyone's looking at you and noticing that you're anxious, and less than they can't tell. But now, of course, I'm up on stage, and in my head, I'm thinking, okay, everyone is looking at me because they know I'm an anxious person. They're seeing, they're looking closely, like, is, you know, sweat, can they see the sweat beating on my upper lip? Can they hear the quaver in my voice? And of course, then you start thinking about that and you get more anxious, and then more sweat does beat on your upper lip, and then your voice starts quavering, and it's sort of this weird meta anxiety. But again, doing it again and again is exposure therapy and makes it easier.
Just one more question then. What does it mean to you then to be shortlisted for the Wellcome Prize?
It's an incredible honor. The success of the book generally, you know, there were times when I thought I would, many times for a long time, when I thought I would never finish it and publish it, let alone have it come out and be generally well received. And, you know, to have, you know, even just to be on the shortlist with all these other tremendous authors and excellent books is just so, you know, it's sort of a validation of a sort that, you know, I couldn't have dreamed of. So I'm incredibly honored, and haven't cured my anxiety, but, you know, on the day that I learned I'd been shortlisted, I was, you know, in a better mood and probably less anxious than I had been the day before. So it's a great honor.
I've been talking to Scott Stossel. We've been talking about his book, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for a Peace of Mind. So, Scott, thank you very much for taking the time to tell me about it.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm Hannah Fry, you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Sarah Moss was educated at Oxford University and is currently an Associate Professor of Creative Writing at the University of Warwick. She is the author of two novels, Cold Earth and Night Waking, which was selected for the Fiction Uncovered Award in 2011. She spent 2009 and 10 as a visiting lecturer at the University of Iceland and wrote an account of her time there in Names for the Sea, Strangers in Iceland, which was shortlisted for the 2013 RSL Ondaatje Prize. Her latest novel, Bodies of Light, was published by Granta Books in 2014 and is shortlisted for the 2015 Wellcome Book Prize. So, Sarah, thanks for talking to me today.
A pleasure.
How would you describe what the book is about?
Well, it's about the first generation of women doctors in Britain who were being trained in the 1870s mostly. But it's also about growing up as a daughter in an artistic household where the father's work is valued and where there's a tension between the father's commitment to art and the mother's commitment to social justice. And about how daughters in particular might arrange themselves in relation to those two very driven but very different adult personalities.
So let's talk about some of the characters then. So Alfred Mobley, who is the father, who's a Pre-Raphaelite painter. That's a world that we normally associate with a certain libertinism and the romantics. And his wife, who is, as you've just described, his wife Elizabeth, is a, you know, a campaigner for social justice, for women's rights and for the poor. But she's a evangelical woman who's incredibly driven and dogmatic. Let's talk about the tension between those two worlds. I mean, when you were researching this, did that sort of tension exist?
Yes, I think so. And of course, it's not, I mean, that marriage is inherently unlikely. But my experience even now is that a lot of marriages are inherently unlikely. The strangest people to get together, even in a world of social networking and long premarital relationships. And particularly for the Pre-Raphaelites, who tended to be very interested in what women looked like and not necessarily very interested in what they thought. There are some totally disastrous marriages. And I was interested in being a child of a disastrous marriage and growing up pulled into having two totally incompatible sets of expectations so that you're never really going to be sufficient, because even if you please one parent, the other one will be gravely disappointed.
And let's talk about, we'll talk about Alfred first then, who he is, because, I mean, as you just described, not only is he, you know, he's not really aware of his wife, but even more so, he has no idea really or no interest in what is happening to his daughters, does he?
Some. I mean, he protects them a bit from Elizabeth. The other thing about the Pre-Raphaelites and social justice campaigners is that they have a certain amount in common. I mean, they're both rejecting the Victorian expansion of capitalism and urbanisation and the interest in factory-made stuff. Both of them are deeply suspicious of that desire to have more and more and more stuff and more and more and more money so you can have more and more stuff. And they're coming to it from very different points of view. One on aesthetic grounds because the stuff is horrible, and one on moral grounds because we shouldn't be thinking about stuff. But they're both interested in simplicity and paring back and living a kind of plain life. So there is, you know, on a kind of aesthetic and political level, there's stuff in common there, even though it's realised for two very different sets of motives.
And Elizabeth, let's talk about how she has become the way she is, because as is often the case, Elizabeth was treated the same way by her own mother.
Yes, and you at the beginning, you're supposed to be able to see that there's just this slight opening of a possibility that it could go a different way. But she ends up replicating her own childhood, as very many of us do. Interestingly, this bit was kind of inspired by Little Women, which I read as a child as being a book, a nice, gentle book, you know, and they're feminists in you. Louise Ralcott was a feminist and the March sisters are feminists. And rereading it when I was older, and particularly rereading it as a feminist literary critic, you begin to realise that a lot of the feminism in that book is about internalising oppression and limits and learning to control yourself in ways that can actually be quite violent. I mean, Jo has to learn to control her temper. Amy has to learn not to want stuff, not to want nice food, not to want pretty dresses. Meg nearly brings down her virtuous marriage over the desire for a pretty dress. It's a very harsh kind of feminism which functions by requiring women to internalise a kind of social violence. And that is to some extent where the British feminisms of the 19th century are also coming from. But the more I researched it, the more I could see how those pressures would drive you to that kind of self-destruction. Because one of the issues for a feminist woman in any period is that if you're interested in clothes and prettiness and enjoying things, material things of any kind, you're trivial and fluffy and selling out. But if you're not, then you're assuming a masculine role and you're denying all sorts of things. And there isn't really any space in that very theorised way of thinking for pleasure, you know, for doing what you feel like doing, because you're constantly thinking, do I feel like doing this because I've been socially conditioned to feel like doing this? Is it permissible for me to feel like doing this? And if you combine that with the evangelical Christian interest in self-examination and virtue and trying to subdue all of your worst urges, you end up in a position where you almost can't do anything because you're constantly checking with yourself about why you would want to do it and whether your ideological motives are okay. It's totally disabling. And that's also the experience of growing up afraid of a parent. You're not thinking about what you want, you're thinking about what they want. You're reading them, you're checking from the body language how they're likely to react to anything. So you end up very driven, very capable of huge levels of self-control, but almost out of touch with your own desires and interests. And that's a very powerful position to be in. I mean, that's the position of somebody who can absolutely defy the Victorian patriarchy and become a doctor. But it hurts.
And that's the journey that Ali, one of the daughters, will take, and we'll come on to her in a moment. But just staying with Elizabeth for a bit, I mean, even, you know, beyond her upbringing, you know, she's an evangelical Christian, she's a social campaigner, and the world that she throws herself into, the underworld of Manchester, of sort of workhouses and asylums and brothels, I mean, it's like a living hell. I mean, it's sort of all of her sort of fears realised. So tell me a little bit about that world and about researching it and what that was like.
Well, I already sort of knew about it. I grew up in Manchester and went to a school which was founded by the Manchester Liberals in the 19th century. So materially, that world was absolutely around me as I was growing up. And I lived in a Victorian house, and so did almost everybody else I knew, because most of the housing in Manchester is Victorian. I went to school in Victorian buildings. When we went to the hospital, it was a Victorian hospital. When I went to the library, it was a Victorian library. So my sense of the Victorian city was quite strong. And of course, growing up in a place like that, in primary school, you're always doing Manchester in the Year of the Victorians, and then you do it again at GCSE and again at A-level. So I had quite a deep sense of that going back quite a long way. And then my academic interests are 18th, 19th century, and particularly Romantic poetry and Romantic era women's writing. And they were all people who were very engaged with social justice in the world of the city. So I don't think I discovered much that was new and shocking in researching this book. And I'm not sure I'd have dared to write historical fiction if I hadn't had that kind of deep, long-term familiarity with the period. But I think historical fiction is always at least as much a prophecy as a memory, and at least as much a warning as a kind of nostalgia. And while I was writing this book, I was hearing a kind of Victorian rhetoric about poverty. You know, it was when we were having the Strivers and the Skivers rubbish, which is just the Victorian division between the deserving and the undeserving poor. We've got food banks again. You know, we have kids with malnutrition out on the streets. It didn't seem terribly far off a kind of reality to which we might be returning. So part of the book is a kind of furious warning. You know, things used to be like this. We used to be dependent on the goodwill of people who didn't have anything more urgent to do to feed children who were otherwise going to starve. And we're walking back into that. And nobody seems to be able to see that that's exactly where we were 150 years ago.
I'm Marcus Chown, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Let's look at the daughters then. So there's May and Ali, and this the book really becomes Ali's story. But May Moberly is a character from your previous novel as well, Night Waking, which is, it's not a, that's a novel that's set in different time periods. This is a historical novel, so it's not like, you know, the second part of a trilogy or something. But let's talk about why you've done that. Why did you want to bring back the characters or concentrate on that family?
When I wrote Night Waking, has a split narrative between, there's a present day one and then there's a kind of Victorian one running behind it. And I just knew a lot more about the Victorian family than ever made it anywhere near Night Waking. And one of the things I'm interested in Night Waking is the relationship between academics and the things they're researching and the things that they don't know, the things you never find out as an academic researcher. So in Night Waking, you only get the bit that the academic finds out, which is very little. But in order to write that very little, I had to research and learn and think through a whole lot more. I mean, you know, you can't write about the bit of the iceberg that shows until you know what there is underneath. So the story just took shape towards the end of writing Night Waking. It wasn't, I mean, my books are never planned in that sort of way. They form and I find them and I'm interested in them, but I don't set out and think, next I'm going to write a book about 19th century social history, which will be related to the previous book in the following ways. It just kind of emerges as I read and think. But I like the idea of constructing a parallel world in picking up minor characters. So it doesn't matter at all. It's for readers who have read both. I'm trying to, the connection will be amusing, and it's amusing for me. But it doesn't really matter. I could equally well have produced a different Victorian family with a similar kind of history.
But having done that for a second time then, will you continue to do that? Do you think it's something that's worth exploring more?
My next book, Science for Lost Children, which will be out this summer, is another book about Ali. And it picks up more or less where Bodies of Light leaves off. I mean, it's not exactly a sequel, it's a standalone, but it's the same characters in another place.
So Ali becomes part of a group of women who were the first doctors, basically, the first people to be allowed to call themselves doctors. So that was, there was basically, it's a sort of parallel with a real group of women that existed in the late Victorian period. So tell us about the reality. Let's talk about that group of women, who they were and about that world.
It was part of, well, feminism in the 19th century as now was quite often seen as a middle class movement about the fulfillment of middle class women. And one of its early projects was to claim a professional life for women and to begin to open up some equality of opportunity. I mean, it takes a very long time to get to full equality, but that was one of the things that 1870s feminists were trying to do. And medicine was important, I think, for two reasons. And one of them is the intimacy of it, that women really wanted to be able to see women doctors. But I think medicine opened to women so much earlier than, for example, law, because there were both radical and conservative arguments for women doctors. The radical argument is that women have been healers since time immemorial, and there's plenty of evidence for medieval woman healers, and that women are equally capable and should be allowed equality of opportunity in that area. But the reason that it opened to women was that there was also a conservative argument, which was that women should not be obliged to expose their bodies to male doctors, and that modesty dictates that a woman should have access to a female physician. So what the really important one for medicine is the conservative and radical arguments putting pressure on the same place, which is the medical schools to admit women. But even so, it took years and some horrible, horrible things were done. The University of Edinburgh turned out, it wasn't even that they wanted to be open to women, it was just that there was a loophole in their constitution that referred to person rather than man, which meant that when they got almost taken to court over it, they had no legislative basis for refusing to admit women. So there were seven women, they became known as the Edinburgh Seven, who fought their way into Edinburgh Medical School. And they were threatened with rape. They had feces thrown at them, their windows were broken, all by other medical students and members of the faculty. They were sometimes physically thrown out of lecture theatres. They were bullied beyond imagining. We think misogynist bullying is a phenomenon of Twitter and the internet, but it's really not. It was going on physically at that era. And they kept going, and some of them got top marks, which of course annoyed the people who opposed them even more. They weren't allowed to attend some lecture courses because it was thought that they would distract the men, so they had to buy in private teaching to cover that ground. They were allowed to take the exams, and they passed, and several of them did extraordinarily well. But then they weren't allowed to graduate, because it turned out that the bit of legislation that said you couldn't stop women getting into the medical school allowed you to refuse to let them graduate. So they'd done the training, they'd bought in a lot of it themselves, they'd stood up to 7 years of relentless bullying. They'd taken and passed their exams, and they still, after all that, they still weren't allowed to call themselves doctor, and they couldn't legally practice in the UK.
And even beyond that, I mean, it's often you might think these stories are of these are the brave pioneers, and then after that it becomes then there are women doctors, you know. But that's of course not really what happens, is it?
No, most of them had to go off to, I mean, America had medical schools that were open to women from the 1850s and 60s. So some of them went to America and qualified there and came back. The ones in Paris had been open to women for a while, and Dublin. So there were places women could go and qualify and then come back. But of course, the numbers who could do that are tiny. And then it was really the next generation, which is where Ali comes in, had the London Hospital for Women, which was really a women-only medical school. There were some men teaching at it. And that was when women were able to teach women and begin to pass on the expertise. It was still very difficult for things like surgery. You know, there was one woman surgeon. It just takes quite a long time.
Let's talk about researching that world and that story. I mean, was this a story that was forgotten, or is there a lot of memoirs and documentation about those times?
There's surprisingly little. I mean, you know, there's a group of academics who know about it, of course, as about almost anything. There wasn't much. There were a couple of memoirs. There's only one of that very early generation, Mary Sharleap, that's interesting because she starts off in India and comes back to England and trains and goes back to India and comes back. So that's part of an imperial and colonial narrative, as well as a feminist one, which is interesting because there we have feminism on the side of imperialism and colonialism. There wasn't much. I had to reconstruct it out of fragments, really. I read a lot of 19th century surgical textbooks because it's quite easy to get to what people actually do. You know, what would Ali be able to see? What would her hands be doing? What books would she be reading? But for the environment of the women's medical school, there were 2-3 fairly fragmentary memoirs, which in some ways is nice. I mean, for me, fiction begins where history goes quiet. So once I'm sure that I know where history goes quiet, then I'm confident.
Finally, then, what does it mean to you to be shortlisted for the Wellcome Prize?
Oh, I'm delighted, of course. It's wonderful. And it's a very strong shortlist. I mean, anybody would be flattered to find themselves in that company. And particularly because across several books, I'm interested in writing, and particularly in how, I mean, Alfred is a painter. I'm interested in the relationship between painting and medicine and writing. As a Pre-Raphaelite painter, he's looking at bodies in one way and his daughter is looking at bodies in a different way. And then, of course, I'm writing into that space between the artistic and the medical gaze. It's great. It's a brilliant thing to be on that shortlist.
So I've been talking to Sarah Moss about her book Bodies of Light, which is shortlisted for the 2015 Wellcome Book Prize. So, Sarah, thank you very much for telling me about it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our relaunched website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.